bicentennial. What the petitioners did was they asked for a finding by the trial court that they were consumers. And the trial court absolutely refused to give them that finding, and in fact found the opposite, found conclusively that these borrowers did not qualify as business consumers. Before reaching that, I want to talk a little bit about the statutory construction rules which have been discussed today. What guidance does the case law, the rules of statutory construction, and the legislative history give us to tell us whether this matter, which is built into the definition of a qualified business consumer, what precedent do we have for taking it out of the definition of a qualified consumer and judicially transporting it over to the definition section of the DTPA and there calling it an affirmative defense? And in fact, we have no precedent for that kind of a movement. The single clearest indication, the best source we have of how to characterize this issue comes from the statutory arrangement itself. And that statutory arrangement could not be any clearer. The DTPA has a separately labeled section for defenses. It has a separately labeled section for exemptions. This matter, defining an eligible business consumer, does not appear in either of those sections. If the legislature wanted to put the burden on the defendant to disprove consumer qualification as to this $25 million standard, then clearly the legislature would have identified it in the already existing section on defenses. The legislature had a clear choice to draft this provision in a way that would give us the result which the petitioners urged, and it clearly did not. We don't have to guess about what the legislature had in mind with where it placed this particular qualifying language. The case law permits us to presume that the legislature knew what was happening in the case law at the time of the amendment. Here the legislature knew two things, and it knew it very clearly. First, a DTPA claimant qualification as a consumer had been treated consistently in a long line of cases from this court and from the courts of appeals as a matter which was part of the plaintiff's elements of proof, part of the cause of action. The legislature knew that these rules of law had been repeated again and again, and contrary to the reference to the liberal interpretation for consumers, which has been invoked by the petitioners, the legislature knew that this court had said in Riverside that that liberal interpretation does not apply to the definition of a consumer. In other words, that threshold issue of who is entitled to particular statutory benefit is not entitled to presumptions, is not entitled to liberal interpretation. As the petitioners have conceded, Farmers and Merchants versus Ferguson is clear authority for the position which Centennial is urging in this case. In that case, this court ruled that a DTPA claimant had to prove its coverage under the Act, and that that coverage and that proof included evidence that the consumer was not disqualified under the exclusionary language of other than for business or commercial uses. Similarly here, the business consumer is qualified, whether a business consumer is qualified for relief is going to depend upon showing that they don't fall within the disqualifying language. Farmers and Merchants is clear on this, and Farmers and Merchants is clear with a long line of authorities having to do with this statutory construction and treatment of exceptions. So what the petitioners are really asking when they ask the court to look or overrule Ferguson is they're asking the court to overlook an anthology of cases on statutory constructions which makes some very practical distinctions key to this case. The first one is there is a fundamental and profound difference in this treatment of exceptions to statutes about whether you're dealing with an exemption from liability, an escape clause, saying that the plaintiffs aren't liable, that the defendants aren't liable, whether you're dealing with an exemption from liability or a disqualification from maintaining the cause of action. And the case law is clear on this. If you're talking about something which is built into the description of who is qualified to maintain the cause of action, that matter has to be disproved by the statutory claimant. If you have a definition that sets limits, that somehow qualifies or restricts eligible plaintiffs, the plaintiff has to negative the exception, is the way the case law refers to it. Put a little more practically, you have to prove you didn't fall within that limiting language. The wealth-based exclusion of the DTPA obviously has to do with who can maintain a cause of action rather than any exemption from liability. It's significant that the petitioners have cited no authority in which qualifying language built into the definition of any statutory claimant has been held to be an affirmative defense. While it may not be the most sophisticated analysis, it's clear that one's inability to bring a cause of action because you're not a covered beneficiary simply doesn't sound like an affirmative defense. The second point, which I want to summarize, is that the Court of Appeals was correct in affirming the trial court judgment because we're not dealing with a case where the issue of the burden of proof is necessarily determinative. Regardless of which way this court decides to go with the assignment of the burden of proof, whether to remain with the case law, keeping this as part of the plaintiff's cause of action, or to recast this as an affirmative defense, the assignment of the burden of proof has no consequence in this case because regardless of which side you put it on, Centennial proved conclusively that the borrowers were disqualified from coverage. After reviewing the only evidence valuing the borrowers' assets, Judge Bosworth at the district court level ruled and found that the borrowers conclusively did not qualify for relief. The only evidence of the borrowers' assets, which was introduced at trial, were their own financial statements, again totaling $28.5 million. There were no competing valuations. The evidence came in this form of financial statements, and I don't see the problem with relying on financial statements, which the petitioners have raised, particularly in the business setting. These are the same representations of wealth which the borrowers made in order to induce Centennial to continue in this transaction. These were the financial statements submitted in response to pre-closing requests for financial statements. This is part of the representation of wealth which the borrowers made to Centennial. And these financial statements, they are conclusive. And why are they conclusive? Because they're made under penalty of violating federal law. The approach which the petitioners take to challenge this result is that the borrowers may not have been worth what they said they were worth. There are a number of problems with this approach, in addition to the fact that they were not able to adduce any evidence showing that anyone had personal knowledge to challenge any of the valuations of assets contained in the financial statements. Over and above that, there's a policy consideration here about whether the borrower should be able to claim an advantage from what they claim now may have been a misrepresentation in their own financial statements. No matter how the evidence is viewed, it is conclusive that these borrowers did not qualify for relief, not just that they didn't prove relief. In summary, the legislature has provided that the business consumer will not have DTPA remedies available to them unless their assets are worth less than $25 million. In light of the legislative directive on this point, in light of the collective wisdom we can gather from the statutory arrangement itself, from longstanding Texas case law requiring that the plaintiff in a DTPA action prove its cause of action, including consumer status, and specifically unproving or specifically disproving this exclusionary language, and in light of the ease of access to proof which the plaintiff will have to prove this issue, it's wholly inappropriate to recast this as an affirmative defense. Second, regardless of the assignment of the burden of proof, whether it remains with the plaintiff's case and cause of action or is changed to become an affirmative defense, the judgment in favor of Centennial must be affirmed because the evidence was conclusive that these were not qualified business consumers. Wherefore, Centennial Savings Bank requests that the judgment of the trial court and the Court of Appeals be affirmed on the grounds herein discussed. Alternatively, Centennial requests that this court review its no evidence or rendition points, and again affirm judgment of the trial court and court of appeals based on those points. Alternatively, Centennial requests that the matter be remanded to the court of appeals for a consideration of our no evidence and factual insufficiency points.
Any questions?
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, in response to the Chief Justice's question, we sought initially remedies for breach of contract and for DTPA. The trial court declared a mistrial and we withdrew our breach of contract action and the trial court set aside the mistrial. That's the reason we're not in the court, we're in court here only because of the DTPA, because if we hadn't confined our claim to the DTPA, there would have been a mistrial.
Am I to understand that you have a pending contract action, a separate action?
No, the court dismissed it with prejudice. We don't have a contract action in this case anymore. But that's why we're here today, only under the DTPA. That's the factual setting in which that happened. With regard to whether we were or were not surprised, let me say this. The words $25 million or more do not appear in the record until the defendant's motion for instructed verdict at the close of all evidence, not close of our evidence, the close of all evidence. They say we pled it. We didn't plead it. We pled business consumer.
What was their special exception?
What's that?
Was the content of their special exception that caused you to replead?
Caused us to replead.
You did not have the word business consumer in your original.
Yes. They said that we had not shown that we were a consumer under the act. And we repled some facts to show that we were a consumer, that we acquired goods and services, and we also said we were a business consumer. But neither their exception nor our repleting spoke of the $25 million or more exception.
Nor did it mention the section of the act. That's correct.
The first time the words were mentioned was after the evidence was closed. Moreover, regardless...
Who put these financial statements in evidence?
I don't even know who put them in.
They were in evidence.
Oh, they were in evidence, yes. Now, the reason that they came into evidence was not material for that. The reason that it came into evidence was that they were trying to show the jury that the reason they didn't make the loan was because our financial status had been declining. Our financial status was at issue in this case, and it was at issue in regard to a very hard-fought question in front of the jury. Was Centennial justified in not making the loan because our financial condition had gone downhill? That, in fact, was tried very hard. That's how the financial statements came in. That's how all the evidence concerning our financial status came in. And it was only at the motion for instructed verdict that they first mentioned $25 million or more.
Was there a limiting instruction that the evidence was admitted for the sole purpose of that issue?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't. The point I'm saying is that we were surprised. Now,
what other evidence was there?
Well,
about the financial condition.
Ms. LaValle mentioned that the financial statements are conclusive, and I think that's what you're asking there. We say the jury could have, first of all.
Not conclusive, just was it ever contradicted?
Was it ever what?
Was it ever contradicted?
Yes, well, did we get up and contradict the financial statement?
If we look at the statement of facts and find out what evidence is there to contradict the $28.5 million, what do we find?
All right. First of all, we find that our financial statements, the three plaintiffs, do not total $25 million. They have to put in the fourth partner in the venture, Mr. Jackson, whom we were feuding with, whom we think was in league with them, and who everybody agreed had serious credibility problems. That's how they get the $25 million first.
Oh, was he a part of this venture?
He was a part at one point. He was a part of the venture. But the point is, I'm just saying, the point is this, that even if he's in there, even if we include his worth in there, the fact is there is evidence from which the jury could have concluded that all four of us had less than $25 million. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm waiting to hear where we find that evidence.
Okay. There was no evidence in the record that we had as to another figure for assets. You see what I'm saying? There wasn't evidence in the record that, in fact, we had exactly $20 million. They put the financial statements of the four ventures.
Well, let's get to Mr. Jackson. Was he a plaintiff in this cause?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. He was part of the partnership, originally, but he wasn't a plaintiff in this cause of action.
Was the partnership still in existence at the time of the lawsuit?
I don't know, and I don't think we reached that issue, because even if we include Mr. Jackson, the jury could have still concluded that we had less than $25 million. The point is, when they put all four financial statements in, we got a little over $25 million. Then Centennial, during the whole trial, sought to prove that everybody's financial condition had declined. Our financial statements, first of all, were given 4 months after the operative date, the date the loan was closed. And secondly, Centennial put on a great deal of evidence to show that our financial statements weren't correct. That in fact, one of the reasons that they say they didn't make the loan was because one of our partners, they had serious doubts about one of our partners' financial status. We say that from that, the jury could conclude that we had less than $25 million. That's some evidence. That's the kind of inferences the court has allowed people to make in resolving no evidence questions. The evidence is in the brief, but that's basically our argument. You can get into the question of Mr. Jackson and is he part of the venture and do we count his financial statement if you want to, but I submit to you that's another question and you don't have to. The no evidence point can be resolved simply when you take all four people's financial statements and you connect the fact that there was some evidence that the parties didn't have as much as they said they did.
Well, at what point in time does this $25 million control, if it not at the time of your alleged DTCA infraction?
We say that the time it controls is the time that we close the loan.
Okay, and that date is in the record.
What's that?
And that's
in the record.
And the financial at that time, all four partners, including Jackson, were part of the joint venture.
Yes, Your Honor, they were. And then 4 months later, the financial statements come. The financial statements were prepared 4 months later after that. All we say is that there's... Yes, sir.
Did you say that after the date of the loan was funded?
The loan was never funded. The date the loan was closed. What happened was we went to a closing, we acquired land, or we refinanced land, I believe, and the bank advanced us $54,000 to pay the two-point commitment fee, 2 points on $2.7 million. We paid it back to the bank at that time. We say that's the operative date upon which the $25 million or more issue must be resolved. Moreover, regardless of whether we were surprised, and this is important, they haven't shown you any way that a plaintiff is not going to be surprised in the future. That trap is still out there. They haven't shown you one way that if you uphold the Dallas court, this question will not come again and again.
That's the business consumers.
Well, we say it's all consumers. If the plaintiff doesn't, if the plaintiff simply, buying the house case, if the plaintiff doesn't affirmatively show that he's not buying it for business purposes and simply remains silent, as people will often do, he hasn't negated the exception. If you take their approach, the plaintiff has to negate both prongs, business consumer and $25 million, or business consumer or $25 million. You have to treat them both the same.
You take the position that someone who has the burden of proof on a burden of pleading or asserting an exception has the burden of getting a jury finding on it?
In this case, we do, Your Honor. As a general proposition, I don't know. But I submit that in this particular case, it was the defendant's burden to plead it, defendant's burden to come forward with evidence, and defendant's burden to get an issue. Now, let me just say one thing. With regard to the fact that no issue was submitted, we say there's evidence both from which the jury can conclude that both there was $25 million or more, or there wasn't $25 million or more. No issue was submitted, and neither side objected to the omission of an issue. We say if it's their burden, they lose. They lose because they did not submit any issues with regard to that, quote, defense. That's Rule 279. If it was our burden, we don't lose. If it's our burden, Rule 279 comes into play. We submitted all the other elements of our case, and under Rule 279, the way I read the law, you've got to send it back to the trial court and let him decide the fact issue.
One issue with this, two things.
Yes, sir.
One, what issue is this necessarily referable to? And secondly, how would it be deemed in support of the judgment if the judgment was zero?
Okay. First of all, what issue was it necessarily referable to? If it was part of our cause of action, if it was one of the elements in our DTPA cause of action, as they say, we submitted proof that there was actionable conduct, we submitted proof of producing cause, an issue on producing cause, and we submitted an issue on damages, those were all answered. It's referable to our DTPA cause of action. It is an element of it according to them. If it was not an element of it, if it was their burden, if it was their burden, then they did not submit any other issues under Rule 279, under Colonial Savings Association, a case we cited in our reply brief, and a whole raft of other Supreme Court cases and Court of Appeals cases. This court cannot presume a finding in favor of the judgment once there's been a grant of judgment NOV. Presumed findings are out. The court must remand back to the trial court and let the trial judge decide whether or not we had assets of $25 million or more. I think the case is very clear on that point. We don't particularly want that to happen, but if the court finds against us on the burden of proof issue, then I think that's the necessary result of the case.
The sad thing is,
yes.
From a conservation of energy standpoint, is that an issue could have been submitted that didn't place the burden of proof, that was an either-or issue.
Yes.
Like in a comp case, and they could have reserved the question of who the burden of proof was, and this matter would have been settled, and the judge could have ruled however he wanted to as a matter of law, and we could have come back up here without a new trial.
Yes, that's right. But with regard to conservation of energy, let me say this, that if the respondent's position is upheld, the plaintiff in every DTPA case is going to have to introduce evidence of his wealth.
Well, neither side has argued that this might be a situation where one party has the burden to raise the issue, but the other party has the burden to
That's
prove
right.
it because of who has the most knowledge.
Nobody has gone into the swaying burden of proof argument, but let me just say this. They say we could stipulate. Well, that could be taken out by stipulation that the plaintiff did not have assets of $25 million or more. Well, it takes two to stipulate. And if the plaintiff may not want to stipulate, the plaintiff may want to ask his client this question. Ms. So-and-so, how much money do you have? Well, we lost it all in the fire. That's what could happen if, in fact, you say that's part of the plaintiff's case. The plaintiff won't stipulate. Maybe they could just plead that the plaintiff was not a business consumer. That might get them into trouble, just like it did us.
Were the financial statements warranted?
What's that?
Financial statements that your clients warranted when they did a bank and trying to get a loan?
Were they warranted?
Sworn.
I don't know. I don't know. And whether they were or not does not mean that it's conclusive evidence. If they tried to prove during the whole trial that we didn't have as much money as we said we did, then we say that the jury should not be stopped from concluding that we didn't have as much money as we said we did. That's all.
Do you think we could take judicial notice of the fact that borrowers who submit financial statements to bank nearly always overstate their net worth?
The court could probably take judicial notice of that, Your Honor. I would hate to be the one to argue that, but sure you could. But I just want to point out this. As I said, that's the type of argument that's going to be waiting for you if you countenance that business consumers are somehow different from ordinary consumers. Now estoppel, conclusive evidence, who knows what's next. I believe that's all I have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think I speak for the whole court in saying we appreciate the excellent